Hello and welcome to this bare bones kind of conversation podcast with me, Corey. And today I have with me Mark Doyou Albin, who was my first introduction to Zen. And I feel very fortunate to have him here to talk with him. He has this really amazing, expansive mind. And I'm curious to see what comes out of it today. So welcome, Yusan, as I say. Welcome, Yusan.
Hey, Corey.
Hey. Great to see you.
So when I first went to Tahoma, Yusan was the person that I met. And I remember being Yusan's kind of really powerful guy, and really pushed my buttons in a lot of ways, but also was so impressive to me. And I saw that Zen has a lot of depth to it, that a guy like me who likes sports and, you know, girls and all that, I met Yusan and I saw, this is someone who's a normal kind of cool, handsome guy. And he kind of found this freedom through this training. And I wanted to talk with him today and see where it would go. So can I ask Yusan, what got you to Japan? And what was it that made you get to Japan from LA, Los Angeles?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a question I sometimes ask myself, if I really understand how it all kind of happened. I think things just sort of got me there because I was supposed to go there, but maybe the story's fun, you know, to hear. Growing up in the 60s, whatever, when going through the in Orange County, and then early 1980s, I was in UCLA, and it was really a conservative time socially, right? In Orange County, I mean, there was things going on, and I really didn't feel very comfortable as an Orange County guy. I remember this bumper sticker, Democrat, there are Democrats in Orange County, you know, 10%. You know, and Orange County is now Democratic, by the way. But back then, you know, I really didn't like the USA, right? I really, you know, in my freshman class, 17 years old, I'm sitting there in a university lecture with Gary Nash. He wrote a book called Red, White, and Black, The History of America from 1550 to 1750, sort of how it really, before, you know, the what we got in history is pilgrims and then revolution and civil war, but actually, you know, we won World War II. And America's just so great. And this story was a story of, you know, treachery, right? And manipulation. And, so frankly, I was, you know, my suspicions were fulfilled through a real doubt about materialism anyway. That's a long story with my own family. In any case, I started thinking already about traveling, right? I had already traveled a couple times to Europe, and I went to Europe again in 1983, 84. I gotta learn a language. I gotta get out. I gotta get culturally out. And then German just kind of came because my sister did French and my brother did Spanish. So I got to be different, right? I'm the youngest. So in German. And it was an exchange program. And I got to Europe for a year, and I really was interested in history, right? I was studying history, and boy, they grilled me, you know, they really wanted to know what I thought about you know, these nuclear weapons being there. I mean, they were 100,000 people resisting the nuclear bombs being stationed there. And, you know, there was this border. I was in Göttingen. It was only about 30 miles from the eastern border. I'm from Southern California, right? And borders, right? Like serious guns, serious soldiers, and serious repercussions. I mean, people were separated from their families. Not to mention terrible weather, you know, that people are living in a gray zone. And I went over there. I went to Poland. I went to the Czech Republic, or back then Czechoslovakia, and went to East Berlin. And it was really, you know, I come from, you know, LA. I grew up, you know, I worked at the Playboy Mansion. You know, I have a funny history, right? So here I am in like this con, people in line for nylons and cigarettes yeah, I had funny things happen to me where I just got really pushed back, that everything I was learning in America was so different than how other people lived. I had one fraternity brother, right? I went to UCLA and I was in a fraternity the first 2 years, and he was this nice, naive guy, and he had relatives in Poland he wanted to see, and he just picked me up and said, "We're going to Poland, we're going to Oświęcim." And I'm like, yeah, let's see Poland. You know, no one goes to Poland. Let's go to Poland. Oświęcim is actually the Polish name for Auschwitz. My brother, he didn't know it, and I didn't know it. And, you know, we get there, and, you know, all of a sudden it kind of dawns on me that history has happened here. And we met the people, and we started talking to them, because that was 1983. There was still people alive who had experienced quite a bit. You know, telling us that they could smell it and they kind of knew it, and giving us vodka, you know, and offering us their daughters to marry, and you know, driving us, you know, 200 miles for like €4, and being very, very, like, crying when we gave them the money. I mean, things were happening that were kind of too much, you know, for me. You know, I was a baseball player and no one was playing baseball but the Koreans over there in Germany. And so I was. And then I came back to the States to finish up college, and it was the re-election of Ronald Reagan, you know, and there were all these rallies, you know, and there was Will Rogers and this game show host, and they're like, I want a president who kicks some ass on the Russians, and everybody cheered like a football, you know, and I was used to these German guys, you know, rolling their cigarettes and asking me difficult questions and giving me low grades because I didn't have a Marxist perspective, really understanding of that. And so then the apartheid thing was going on back then too, right? And there was a big, at UCLA campus, there was a big, it was a big spot for that. They demoed against the whole UC system was sponsoring Coca-Cola. They were invested in South Africa, and that worked, right? They were stubborn, and they were cool, kind of. And I went to a lot of rallies, and I went to Berkeley for a demo, and I was kind of like, okay, this is how you change the world. But it wasn't really my people either, you know, running around doing communist slogans hand in hand with people. I just didn't feel it, you know, that this was how, although they were doing great things, you know, there was I remember at one rally, this big Afro-American guy was just like, by any means. And no one around could hear what was said because he was just going off. And, you know, it wasn't approaching my understanding of how these problems began and how they might be resolved. I don't know. I didn't see it. I hadn't seen it yet. And so I was in this office. I had a campus job, wondering what the heck I'm going to do. I applied for grad school at Berkeley and UCLA and in intellectual history. I was reading Hegel and Nietzsche and trying to figure all that out. But I was also taking history of religions. And I had met a monk in one of the classes. A guy from Sri Lanka came to one of the classes, and the guy was relaxed. You know, he was round, he was soft, you know, we all thought he was 10 years younger than he was, and he was really clear and had a good perspective. And I had this, you know, heavy backpack and, you know, 300 to 500 pages a week of reading, and I'm like, I gotta really think about what I want to do here. And then a book came into my hands that said Jobs in Japan. It was in this office where I was helping other kids wanting to study abroad. And the guy just said, hey, you know, if you're a college grad, you're going to get a job. It's absolute black market, but Japan is waiting for you to come and teach them conversational English. And I'm like, I'm in. And I got myself a one-way ticket for my graduation. Somehow they all kind of said, okay, you know, and there I was off to Japan to start my way to India. You know, I thought I'd raise some money and do my thing. I mean, I'd studied, you know, I mean, I did have some interest. I had a history of Hinduism class. I had a couple of Buddhism classes. I had gone to two talks in Ojai of Krishnamurti and had already started to churn. Read some Hermann Hesse books, you know, been to a Ravi Shankar concert, getting my things going towards India, right? But Japan was like a good like stop because I'd seen some Zen things. I'd read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, and kind of, I went to the Zen Center in Los Angeles. That was a kind of a funny story. I was at the time taking care of my brother in downtown in LA, in West LA, and I went to Norwalk where the Zen Center was, for the LA Zen Center, you know, the beginning was like I had read I'd read another Zen book or two about breathing or something, and I thought I have to try this. So, you know, they had 8 o'clock a Zazenkai beginner's hour on Sunday, and you know, I drove, my brother was still in bed, and I drove to the center and kind of sat in my car, took a deep breath, looked at the clock. Oops! 1 minute after eight, I'm too late, gotta go home. And I drove home. You know, I didn't really have the guts to go in there. But then I was really mad at myself. So I practiced, you know, reading my book, how to breathe and hold my hands. And then I went back the next week and I sat with a couple guys from the Maizumi tradition there in LA, and they were super nice and kind of got my first sense that people who did Zazen were actually cool.
Yeah.
So that had happened. And then this going to Japan thing was just sort of like, hey, I made it. I got out. Europe is, you know, back then it was dirty. It was, you know, they hadn't spiffed up, you know, this Cold War thing was still in full swing. I wasn't interested in going back. I actually thought I'd never go back. And then I got in that plane to Japan, 1985, October
1985. Cool. And you went to Japan, and I think you were teaching English, and you had a girlfriend, and you were living there. And then how did you end up at Sogenji with Shota Harada Roshi?
Okay, and yeah, the thing with, I went by myself, like I, you know, and it was fun, you know, the Japanese girls and the Western scene was kind of fun just to get the ayahs out and kind of be in an international scene. That was good. And but then, you know, winter came. I went in October, and dude, it was so cold. I had this experience where I was so cold in the house. It was a Japanese room I rented for, you know, 10,000 yen for $100, and it's a student room, and I couldn't get out of bed because I didn't know it was going to be cold that morning, and I just had never done that. You know, I'm not a big camper, and I'm from Southern California. I never had to get out of bed when it was so cold, and I really had to pee, and it took me a long time. And that day, I went out and got myself a heater, you know, one of those little heaters, because I'm on the side to it. And that night, I sat so close to that heater, I think I was traumatized that I actually had like white eyebrows, you know, everything there, because I was, so I really said the next winter, I'm not going to be so cold. And I started the Aikido. I looked around, I found something to do. And that kind of sort of got this thing going, because the Japanese, I went like 6 days a week, It was very close to my apartment, and I went every day at 11 because, yeah, I had this idea I'm going to stay. And I did cold showers in the winter. They thought I was a nut, but I had this sort of cold trauma. And yeah, and then I just went for it. And this was one of the founder of Aikido's disciples. He was old at that time, and his disciples had really lived as Aikido monks. They had lived as celibate Aikido monks for 10 years, and they were amazing guys. And none of them spoke English. It was Osaka, and it's pretty pragmatic people. And they were kind of warrior samurai guys, and they just threw me around and enjoyed it. And I got good at getting thrown around, and eventually also had a couple moves. And that was good. You know, I developed an energy. But I didn't really know what was going on. And so I took a trip with a buddy of mine. We bought a car in Berlin. We had this idea to drive all through Europe. And we did. We went down to Malaga, and then we drove back up all the way back to Berlin. And I went into a terrible state. You know, I had never lost my ki before, because I didn't think about it. I didn't read books about ki. I didn't think about preserving my ki. I had just whipped myself into shape and lost this whatever it was, and I, you know, and then I started drinking another coffee to think maybe it'll feel better. But it just, I gained in 2 months, I gained like 15 pounds, seriously.
Yeah.
And I came up, my Aikido teacher said, like, you know, and so then I thought, I gotta do something for 10 years. The thought occurred, I gotta do something longer, it needs stability. And then right around that time, I had met in that time a lot of English teachers, and a lot of came back from India. And, you know, they didn't look rejuvenated. They didn't look like they were poetic and they were cool, but they didn't look like they had solved the big problem. And they didn't look like, yeah, that they had sort of solidity to them that I guess I was looking for. So I kind of said, okay, maybe something's here in Japan, maybe I should stay here where it's a little more, so I can get a little more roots here.
Yeah.
And that, then the karma hit. I had a letter from my sister to a temple called Butsuji down near Hiroshima. My sister had a colleague who had stayed there anyways, and it was a weird story. My sister didn't even like the girl, but she wrote me a letter. I had this letter, they let me come, and on the way down to Hiroshima, my first trip in Japan, I stopped in Okayama, and I looked at the pamphlet. They explained there are two gardens in Okayama. One is the big Korakuen, the Yang garden, and one is the small, the Sogenji garden. And I'm going to go play my shakuhachi in the temple there, and I did, and I had this lake there, you know. It was pretty nice. And then this old guy was walking around with his dog, right, Kansei-san, and somehow the dog comes up to me, and I get in a conversation with this guy. You know, I'm totally here with Yodo, right? I mean, I'm really not really thinking, but in a weird way it was like everything was all kind of like a movie anyways, this temple. So I was like, oh, why not an old guy with Albright? I have photos from Kansei-san, you know, and his dog. We had a good conversation, and he explained to me that foreigners were here, and there was, good people here. He somehow communicated it to me, and then I heard English spoken from the, the Osetsuma, but no, not the Osetsuma, the anyways, kitchen, from the kitchen area, and in English I heard, hey, there's a gaijin out there, you know. There's a foreigner. And then another person said, haven't you ever seen one before? And I heard this kind of dialogue, and I thought, you know, a kind of a weirdo like me could actually stay in a place like this if they talk like that, right? So it really went in, right? Yeah. And so anyways, that experience, I saw Nensong also, you know, I saw a foreign nun kind of shining there, and then I saw this place, and it kind of stuck in me, and I went down to Butsuji and had an amazing experience just meditating with these two monks. It was just a very intense two monks just cleaning and cooking and making me do everything when I wasn't doing zazen. And they were just incredibly diligent. And one guy slept a lot in Zazen, one guy really sat good. And the guy just came up behind my back and put his knee right in my back to kind of improve my posture. And I just, okay, that's what I have to do. And I held it. And then after, like I said, we sat like three times a day. And I think the next 2 weeks, I was just kind of in another clear part of myself. And it was really beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
And I decided this is gonna be for me, probably not yet. So, and then these really serious monks, when I told them I was gonna go, the monk looked at me and he actually like cried. I think, you know, those guys were running, you know, in Japan, the people aren't going to monasteries anymore. Like a couple guys have to run big temples. And we had become a little team, you know, eating curry rice for three straight days. And, you know, he taught me to clean the floor, you know, finally they brought me a mop because I was so slow, you know, with the thing on the ground. So I was on, right? You know, I was on. And Butsuji is an amazing temple if you ever get down there. That's they have this pagoda, and around the pagoda in the forest are all these Buddha statues kind of sitting with the, and they all feel like, hey, they're really like there. So that was sort of where I knew it was going there. And then a friend of mine, I told him about it. So Genji was also in a Zen guidebook, and he went there, and I started visiting him at that temple, and kind of knowing I'm working my way in there, and started visit for a day, and then overnight, and then sat in a zendo, did, you know, vows, came for a sesshin, November 1987. And then the Roshi said, I hadn't had Sanzan yet, right? I hadn't, and he's like, you come for the Rohatsu. I was like, I'm not a fanatic, okay? You know, that was pretty intense, like a session, right? And so I came for Rohatsu, of course. And I had, you know, an experience that for me was sort of like, okay, I see how this really is, you know? And
you got a big carrot, kind of. You got a carrot of what was possible. Maybe
I mean, sure, in the middle of the night, you know, when you're sitting there like a hanger, you know, just hanging there, and all of a sudden it all just irons out and your mind is, you know, just a laser of brightness and hangs in there for a while. And you know, then the temple culture kind of is there, and you know, but I had, you know, lost like, I don't know, three kilo, right? Like 6-7 pounds in that session. And you know, I had these huge welts on my shoulders from all the hitting, you know, because it was a pretty rough group at the time. But I didn't care. I was kind of all in, you know, but not, because it didn't make any sense to my sense of my story, right? I really was on the way to India, not joining an international Zen temple. But then so that was 2.5 years of Japan, then I went home. And I saw that I'm gonna go back, and I'm gonna stay in the temple, and that's what I did, February 1988.
88, you moved back to Sogenji?
No, I went to my apartment fully thinking I was gonna, and then Chisan called and said, "Ah, hi, Mark, you coming for Osechin?" And was it January? I'm like, "No!" And of course, 2 days later, I went down to Sogenji and went to Osechin. And, you know, yeah. And then I moved in on February, and yeah, just yeah, that's how it started. I was all in, right? And
I think that it was a pretty intense group at that time, and the Roshi was young, and he was pretty intense guy at that point. Still is, of course, but his teaching style changed throughout his teaching. And how was it like when you were first there?
The Roshi did Samu every day, right? You know, he was out for Samu every day, and he was, it was like cutting branches, and you just got to get out of the way. And then you know, he's got the grass cutter or he's doing something. And, you know, and I really wasn't that excited about the guy at first, right? He kind of reminded me of a lieutenant in the, like, excellent military lieutenant who was going to show me, you know, in my head, I'm only here really for 4 years, for four seasons, you know, to really do this, have this experience. And he is perfect because I'm not attracted to this guy at all, right? He's kind of, you know, got kind of, at that time, had a really, like, strong neck, like a linebacker. He was, like, solid as a rock. And going into Songzhen was, like, you know, for an athlete, it's, like, defeat in the morning, defeat in the evening, you know, absolute. Because, you know, the Susokan, right, like, breathe in front of me, and you're, like, you know, and he's, like, it's okay. So but what also happened where that I had all these Japanese monks came down from Kyoto. Shota Harada had, it was kind of a hot secret, a hot tip. And so these quite a few guys were coming to see him from Kyoto, and four moved in for 3 years. And they were really Soto, right? Soto trained, serious guys. And, you know, me and four, one guy, Daijo, the American guy who had also been in Daitokuji Soto for 5 years. And they, you know, I was kind of like, I got all the teaching, you know, all these guys, you know, all their, all, everything they wanted to pass down to somebody, they passed it down to me. And, you know, my, back then we had no benches, right, for meals, no benches for Teisho. Everything was on the ground. O session was like 16 hours with your legs crossed, you know, and I was kind of like this most of the time. And then, and you know, I didn't care if I, my eyes were open. I thought that they thought I was sleeping enough to hit me. You know, I got hit every time they walked by, you know, with the keisaku, with the stick, right? I counted one morning, I got hit 88 times before 11 a.m., right? You know, they were, and I finally went up to the head monk and I said, so why are you guys hitting me so much? I'm not sleeping. And Daijo, the head monk, said, you got a really good back. Makes that great sound. It's good for the. Great explanation. Thank you so much. No, but it was, you know, it didn't hurt. It just wasn't making that much sense. You know, I really wasn't feeling like this hitting stuff was a problem at all. It was more, why am I so nervous when the guy walks by with a stick and my eyes cross? You know, that shouldn't be happening. I should be stable. I should be strong. That's what the Roshi's trying to show me. Why is it not happening? And because I was just, you know, I was buying into what the Roshi was trying to do, like get me a long breath. Somehow my posture one day just popped up and everyone told me I sat straight. Hey, you know, and then I was just really, able to keep up, you know,
yeah.
Able to keep up with the things then. Once I, you know, something kind of deepened, you know, got that little bit down deeper. And I would
really like to ask you about this now, because I think that in the West, I don't think that people really understand Tanden or energy. And I take that back. Some people really do, but I think as a culture, that's, it's a little bit unknown still. So I would love, I think that you are a person who really got a sense of that with the Roshi and with at Sogenji and in your sitting of what Tanden was and is and what energy is. And I would love if you could talk a little bit about that. That would be really helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, there's, it's really a personal feeling, you know. I think it's easy to read about Tanden in a book, and you know, when we read, we get a mechanical mind. You know, we read a novel, oh, I let my feelings go. I read a book about, you know, my body. I don't soften up. I get kind of structural and mental about it, and then this thing's supposed to function. But it's kind of a sensitive friend, actually, you know. You know, I kind of have this idea, or at least it's like, you know, if it's Ossession, it's like a dragon coming out of the clouds, but those clouds come back, right? I mean, it's not something like, oh, I'm not centered. I mean, I remember Chisan telling me that Taitsu Roshi, right? The Roshi's older Roshi brother and Kancho of Myoshinji and all that, he once told Chison, you know, Shoto Harada, he has it all the time. I don't have it all the time. I lose my point sometimes. He doesn't lose his point. So you know, it's a special art. I have to say, you know, to understand it, but it's worth it, because I think we do tend to understand spirituality as something, well, once I understand it, or once I have an opening experience and feel it, everything's going to start to move in a good way. And it often doesn't, right? It makes more space for a lot more stuff, you know, that's personal, that's collective. And you know, this, I always think of the bamboo tree, right? You know, you ever try to get a bamboo tree out of the ground, right? This, like, it's harder than a stone, this root. It's so powerful, right? And I feel that the Roshi's idea, which he also expressed, is, hey, we can do koans, and some people have it, you know, have a kind of insight to it, but I want someone who can hold their ground with this, who is actually useful, not just talking about koans later. I want someone who actually can carry that zendo. And he used to say to me, hey, you know, I want you to carry 35 people in your belly, you know, and to carry the whole world. And so, you know, that experience, I'll relate my Mokugyo experience, right? You know, you get to come into the Zen temple in the first year, you don't have too much responsibility. You have to do what other people say. You have to try to stay healthy and follow the schedule. But at some point, you get a job. And, you know, inside that job is the first thing that I remember where I contribute to the group, besides cooking. You have to include cooking, right? But the first time really you present in front of the group, your energy is playing that wooden fish drum, right? The Mokugyo. And I had been at the temple about a year, year and a half. And, you know, the Kanon Sutra, right? The Kanon Gyo, it's about 15 minutes long, right? And, you know, you probably remember the first time you played there in the temple, right? And, you know, it looks like, oh, that's what I do, right? Like this. But I tell you, this is not the easiest thing in the world to do, right? You know, like everybody's chanting, you know, they're starting, the Roshi's there, whoa, you know, and then this very Zen chanting, which you've gotten used to and think is good. And you're like, okay, you know, all of a sudden you're like, am I doing it right? And anything in the head just kills it, right? But all of a sudden it's just, you know, it sounds like smack, smack, smack on the wood. And until you lighten up and center, there's just nothing there, right? And so the first time I'm doing this, right, I, you know, kind of get through the Heart Sutra, because you really got to memorize the sutras to be able to really center and do that well, because you got to know when it begins and when it ends, but, and you have to be able to speed up and go down. So it's really something you have to internalize, right? Yes. And it has to go deep in there. Otherwise, you're still hitting the thing, right? And so, so this, you know, and the Roshi, they like to chant fast, right? Back at the beginning, boy, they were really going. So there I was, the first time, just, you know, going, and all of a sudden, you know, a couple of thoughts go in my head, and the whole, you know, everything freezes up, and I'm trying to keep going, and, you know, it's getting tighter and tighter, and I'm listening for the end, and then every sutra I miss the end, because, you know, I'm panicking, and I'm trying, and, you know, missing the end, but, you know, it's my first time, and I'm embarrassed, you know, and we kind of finish the sutras, and we, the whole group, when the sutras are finished, you know, we go to the entryway, right, the Genkan to Iraten, right, and doing the chanting there, we do our chanting there, and then the Roshi, he'll usually turn around, right, and give a bow to the group, right, and before he does this, he announces that there was a chicken with its head cut off running around the hondo, the sutra hall, that morning, and that was pathetic. And, you know, my Japanese was good enough to, somehow I always understand what's, when it's not a compliment. And that made me very angry, you know, to hear that in front of the group and so forth. He was relentlessly unimpressed with all of my playing, right? And so I dedicated myself to getting that thing down, right? The mokugyo, right?
Yeah.
And there was. And so, you know, a lot has to do with, you know, starting with the, you know, having the sense of, you know, where is my perineum, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, and then having a sense of, okay, I'm going to let go into my center, you know, and stop guiding my energy into small points all over the place, right? And I'm going to listen, right? And trust. And then, you know, something starts to, the energy body starts to show itself, you know, this kind of spacious place below the belly. So I say, every time, you know, it's there, right? And there was a time 8 years after that first experience, you know, I was a monk, many things had happened, and I was in the, you know, and I knew the sutras because I had to be dense, you know, I was there, and I was going through the Kanon-gyo, you know, and I was chanting because I love to chant. And at that, and there were days when really I felt like, you know, the things were going to the center of the earth, and every corner of the hondo was full of my playing, you know, but my arms were light, and I was just riding into, you know, 10,000 horses, whatever you want to call it, you know. It was just absolute, I heard everybody's voice, was one voice. I was, you know, but there, it was almost like I wasn't even touching the thing. It was like just this heartbeat of everybody was there, you know. And the point is, right, not that you're good. The point is that everybody can concentrate on their koan. Everyone can chant, and everybody can kind of not compliment on who is playing the mokugyo. They forgot, and you forgot that you played that day because you're just doing what you know where to go. Everyone knows where to go. It's quite a beautiful experience when you stop waiting to hear someone say, did I play well, or did I chant well, or, you know, oh God, that was kind of tough. Did someone notice I tried so hard, you know? And, you know, and then that's why you stay longer. You kind of get that. It's just not special. It's just, it's what it's supposed to be, right? It's supposed to be deep. It's supposed to be clear. It's supposed to be for everybody. And there was a moment though, because I think the Roshi remembered how hard he had been on me. And during the Kanon-gyo, and I was doing my thing, and I was chanting, and I felt really like, you know, I was sort of, you know, I was just a huge kind of watching the whole thing from the sun. And he stopped the sutra, and he looked over his shoulder at me, and he said, today the mokugyo was correct, continue, right? And and I was like, okay, 8 years, one compliment. Okay. So there we go. But, you know, that feeling of centeredness, you're not thinking, oh, now I have Tanden, right? You know, that's not helping. But it's, you know, your friend, and it's, you know, when it's with you. And then, of course, it can be extremely clear. But then when nothing's there, you're not thinking about Tanden, right? The Roshi always says, you know, Tanden, Sekai, you know, like the whole world, right? So when it's really, the point opens up, you know, the energy can flow into the mind and can expand out, and you're not really saying I have to be here. It's like, you know, do I have feet? Do I have hands? Do I have tongue? You know, yes, I'm here. My mind, you know, you have presence, right? So in that sense, that is, you know, where it's really at for me. You know, I remember Dogen. Remember Dogen, the young. He was young when I met him. He came at 17. He was a real samurai, right? A martial artist and so forth. And I had come back from America, and he, you know, the guy used to work out like 12 hours a day, right? You know, he had to do like these things 1,000 times a day, you know? And he said to me, Yusong, do you always have Tanden? And I said, well, America, you know, there's a lot going on, but it was there when I needed it. And he goes, yeah, yeah, it's there when you need it. Yeah, I like that. Yeah, it's there when you need it. And so I would, kind of, you know, if you live from that place and it's important to you and the lifestyle, you know, we have no furniture in our apartment, or, you know, we eat a lot of rice, or we drink our matcha, you know, a little bit straight or whatever. You start to make it your friend, right? Your body wants to center, it wants to have energy there, and you know, you want to live from that place. So sure, I do some qigong, you know, too. And I think there are mantras that make it a little easier to feel. When I started, I was using a book from Koichi Tohei, Qi in Daily Life.
Yeah.
And he gave very good, you know, beginner exercise. You know, when I first lived in Japan, I had that book, and I had a little watch, and I timed my exhalation and I timed my inhalation, and you know, I got a little improvement, I got a little happy about that. But you know, a tone, you know, to feel that, right? And when I teach a breathing, I'll just say, you know, open your mouth by the exhalation and let it, like a spider's web, you know, just, I'm sure I got this from the Roshi, you know, but it's like, you know, it's, yes. And then with the lips, I think it's easier to feel sometimes, stop paying so much attention to the, you know, diaphragm and the tensions and so forth, and just feel, it's moving. I feel the contraction. I feel it open up, and trust that. And it's kind of and I do think it's a very important element to a spiritual life today, because it got kind of, you know, with the modern way of thinking that presence is not such an important part of life, like being a millionaire is important, or, you know, being, you know, having an enlightenment experience is important. But actually, you know, we had guys come to the monastery, very awakened guys. They could not continue with their work. They just had to kind of lean on their shovel and be, which is nice, right? But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't part of a collective flow, and I think not really part of a collective healing. If the lower abdomen is also not part of the human experience, right? You know, the roots, right? And this is taught in Taoism very precisely, right? And took it from that.
I wanna keep going with that a little bit. Your Dharma name was Doyu, which is the way of divine service. Is that right? Something like that.
I like it. I just say it was a way of service, and the Roshi said at my ordination, yeah, he has to help me, so we can call it divine service. I don't mind. I think the guy's pretty divine.
Yeah. And I think you know, when I first started in Zen, it was with you, and I think what I found, you know, so partly so shocking about it was, this real caring, this real, I felt very supported. I felt loved. I felt this compassion. And I think that you were the Jigijitsu, and this whole idea of carrying the Zendo, and this way of service. I think this heart, all of that, I feel like is a big part of what brought me to Zen. And what I love about it is, you know, someone could care about someone like me, who's this confused, you know, I was this confused walking kind of energy problem, but someone who had gotten kind of really something out of this practice, then that overflowed to really help someone like me. I want to kind of talk a little bit about that, or hear any of your thoughts on that, as that's what Zen's about, you know. And I don't, I want that just to be said, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I didn't find that Zen worked if I didn't have that. I wasn't attracted to it if it didn't have that.
Yeah.
You know, when the Roshi asked me to ordain, I was really not excited about it.
Yeah.
And there was a moment where I really had my doubts, and what happened was kind of strange. Just before I was going to go home, and I really didn't know if I was going to ordain or not, the Roshi at a lecture in Cloud Mountain started talking about the Bodhisattva, right? You know, he started talking about which he doesn't usually talk about it. You know, you ask the Roshi about love and he says, oh yeah, the Dalai Lama talks a lot about love. All my students know it's about love. They just know they can't do it all the time and they got to practice, you know? And it's like, okay, you know, it's not about, you know, compassion on a conceptual level at all. It's either you or it's not, right? But when the Roshi spoke about it, you know, and Kuan Yin and Kanon Sama and so forth, I said, oh God, he knows that. I don't know it very well, and I'm not very solid, you know. I should do this. He can take me another step. So that's why I ordained, in fact, yes. You know, this caring thing, you know, we tend to underestimate, you know, we tend to conceptualize it. It really is something that is, you have to see it in each person. Each person has that. Yes. But most of us have to learn kind of how much we judge in our heads and how much we want to differentiate instead of find what's common and really understand another person. And that was a lot of learning at Sogenji, right? Like hating other people or being jealous of other people and not admitting it to myself, resenting other people, you know, rivalries. We were really pressed up against each other and we were kind of a rowdy bunch, you know?
Right.
And being head monk was sort of like, you know, go use a rake. And they're like, I think I'll drink another coffee. You know, how do I do that? But no, people were not just following the form. We were real people, really bumping up against each other. And there was a kind of brotherhood or love, you know, there. You know, and because you felt it in Osession, when that pristine feeling comes and the session clicks, you know, everybody just looks each other in the eye and, you know, we can all bow to each other, you know, and the Keisaku comes, it's all good. And when it's not and things get kind of messy and stuff, and, you know, people blame other people for this, that, and the other, and people act out things because sitting 12 hours a day, sometimes people act out funny parts of themselves, you know, or they just don't act the way they're supposed to, and then you have to find a way to understand them. But this kind of thing, I just learned over and over again at Sogenji without being conscious that that was the scene, the Roshi, you know, the backdrop with which the Roshi just knew he was kind of creating. And, you know, there was one situation where one of the monks who was there a long time had a temper tantrum, and he started throwing the bowls at Bishamon cleaning up, you know, and all these bowls were flying around. And, you know, he had some issues psychologically, but he was a very disciplined guy, a very dedicated guy. And I was head monk and I told him to stop. And it was a kind of a scene. People kind of, you know, cleared out. And I went to the toilet and I thought to myself, I didn't handle that so well. You know, I pulled rank, you know, I told him, you know, I kind of got my voice in, you know, I'm the boss and you do what I say. And he did what I said, but I didn't feel good. And I went to the toilet and I remember, he scared me, you know. I actually felt scared for myself and everybody and felt I had to do something. So I went back to the kitchen and he started laying into me, yeah, such a this, that, and the other. And I said, I'm sorry, you know, you scared me. And there was a silence, right? There was a moment of eye-to-eye contact and recognition. He felt that I had seen him as a person and not as a boss.
Yeah.
And, you know, those things come too. It doesn't come with, you know, learn your zazen, pass your mu. You know, that comes by being around the people and you know, if you make the space, you have moments like that, and then you kind of know there's another way to also approach people. And so I kind of got started with that, but I always had to go back into, you know, my rivalries and difficulties with people to come out the other side and kind of this big and remember, you know, but not even this big, if possible, right? Like just really just, you know, the humility of knowing that nobody in essence, it really is bad at all, right? And but you know, that stuff comes up, right? And this is what's beautiful about the Roshi. He's a very deep, deep person. And when you dive deep, I always say the splash is, you know, pulls up all the stuff from the floor of the ocean, and it's an energetic practice, and stuff's coming up, and you know, we did our best to deal with that. But you know, a lot of heart. And when I do see the people from Sogenji, you know, from those old days, it's quite beautiful,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Wow. So yeah, that's I think where we're all, in the end, you know, sort of touched by it, you know. But in the serious training and the seriousness of it all, we're not conceptualizing compassion, right? It's just
right,
it's either or it's not, you know.
Right.
Glad you liked me, by the way. I thought you were a very very sensitive person, and I knew that if you hung around long enough, you would understand me, and that felt very good to me. So yeah, it's good that you came. Yeah.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I think we have some similarities, and I think, yeah, I could see possibilities in you, and also see myself and my frustrations of my own, whoever I was, you know. But no, very, you were always with me for sure at Sogenji the whole time, even though you were in the States, and then later you were in India, right? And then yes, we might have to do a part two of this, Yusan, and we'll see if that works. We're at about our time limit, and I would love to hear like just some kind of closing words for today. What else you would like to say for today? I think we've got to keep this around an hour. So I'd love to hear kind of for today, our kind of final words, if that's okay.
Well, I guess the, you know, the image that we hold is so strong of Zen. What I love about Zen, you know, I always have this this image of Zen is these guys climbing a mountain, you know, and I broke a bone, but I'm gonna get to the top, and I got a little blood, a little dirt, you know, and I'm gonna make it, and you know, I get to my last kind of strength, and then I get up there, right, and I get a good view, you know, and I've worked through every cell of my body and overcame every stupid thought I ever had and every doubt and every fear, and I'm exhausted, but I'm here, you know, I can relax for a second here, and I turn around, and there's the bus of the, you know, the Jodo Shinshu, we used to say, right, that, you know, the guys who just have to say one bodhisattva's name three times a day, and they kind of like get to come up on the bus, and they're smiling and laughing and like super happy, you know. And the Zen guy's like, you know, maybe they want to come on the bus. Do I take the bus next time, or am I still, you know? But if you don't think about that, right, and you do your flavor, you know, one of the great poems that. That's the only poem I ever used twice, you know, when we did the koans. We can talk about koans a bit next time, but one was, you know, roshite ko nash, you know, great efforts, no results, you know. So, you know, if you're looking for the result, you may start to have conflicts, you know, instead of, you know, benefit from all of that. But, you know, the Roshi, the teachings, everything that we all are actually experiencing is not to, you know, live in a dualistic idea of reward if I do this and, you know, and end of the rainbow kind of thing, but to really be, but be with a certain intensity, right? Give it all. Try not to hold back and think of two things at once, you know, give you just great, make a great effort, you know. Had a lot of benefit for me, so
yes. Well, wonderful. I think people got to get a little taste of, I think, this type of energy that I think you embody. And, you know, something I don't think is all that common. So I'm so glad that we got a little time here, and I really want to do a number two, if that's okay. Because I think I could ask some other questions, and we could go into a little more of that, and then hear about life after training, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. Really wonderful to have you here, and I feel just really, really thankful and blessed that you were here. Thank you.
I love to see you, Corey. And it's nice to see the Roshi there behind you.
We're
gonna do this another time, right?
Okay, please. Okay, I'm gonna go now. Thank you so much, and great.
Ciao.
Ciao.